Passionate Talk Radio with Dr. Pat Basile. Crust-busting your way to an awesome life on America's Voice. VoiceAmerica.com.
You have just stepped into a crust-free zone with Dr. Pat Basile. What is crust? Well, crust is that stuff that stands between you and what you want out of life. Crust is what keeps you stuck. Crust is anything you think, feel, or believe that prevents you from living your deepest heart's desire. So get ready to do some serious crust busting with Dr. Pat Basile and break through those layers of crusty conditioning to reveal the unlimited possibilities available to you to live your life full out. Dare to wonder what your life would be like if you knew you could not fail.
Welcome to the show. You're listening to me, Dr. Pat Basile, and we're doing the thing that we do each and every week, working with individuals, helping each and every one of us break through our limiting beliefs so that we can live life full out. And I am honored to be here with someone that I have admired for a very long time, a pioneer of systems thinking and philosophy, Dr. Irvin Laszlo. Just to tell you a little bit about all that he has done and position this interview for what's to come in future thinking of our world. Let me just say this. He has degrees in music from Franz Liszt Academy in Budapest and in philosophy from Sorbonne in France. And he has been a research associate at the University of Fribourg in Switzerland, visiting fellow at Yale, visiting professor at Indiana and Northwestern universities. He is the founder and president of the Club of Budapest, one of the first representatives in the area of systems philosophy and general theory of evolution. He has published nearly 70 books translated into as many as 18 languages. And in the course of his long academic career on systems philosophy and future sciences, he has worked in teaching and research at a variety of universities. And we are here with Dr. Laszlo today to speak about his brand new book and to touch on some old, I don't even want to call them old, but some thinking that we may not have integrated into the way that we live today. I want to say that he has also been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize this year. What an honor to be with you, Dr. Laszlo.
Well, it's lovely to be here and to talk to you.
I love our conversations. It's just, I went home after speaking with you yesterday, and I thought, wow, you know, where do we want to start with this conversation? And what I realized was that I remember someone saying to me that nature abhors a vacuum. That, you know, if you want to manifest things in your life, create a vacuum and things will just fit in it. But I had no idea of how that related to your current book, Science and the Akashic Field. And you talk about a new paradigm. Could you explain how the paradigm of systems thinking and now the paradigm of holistic philosophy, you know, integrates into our current world today?
Well, first of all, apropos, speaking of nature abhors a vacuum, not only does nature abhor a vacuum, it doesn't permit it.
Oh, there you go.
There is no such thing as vacuum, which means truly empty space. Space is not empty. In fact, a space which we consider to be free of matter, what we consider matter, you know, particles and everything that's built of particles, so the material universe, when there isn't any, there is still energy. And as we said yesterday when we talked, there's a very, very dense flows of energy that are there in this so-called zero-point field. So there is no such thing as a vacuum. We continue calling it that because, you know, force of tradition. For the past 200 years, talked about the vacuum. First one thought it was full of the ether, you know, the idea of the luminiferous ether. And then it turned out that this ether doesn't manifest itself as it was expected at the beginning of the 20th century, and then they threw out the ether. They said that there is nothing. And in between, things kept crawling back, creeping back into the empty space until it's now considered to be the womb of the universe and the location of all of the forces and fields of nature.
Mm-hmm.
So this changes, of course, you ask how does this fit into our current thinking. This changes tremendously our conception of the world. The traditional conceptions of the classical conception that is still in most people's heads is that what is there as reality? Reality, pieces of matter, running around and colliding with each other, you know, having this famous causality, one thing affecting another thing. And all that takes place in empty space. I mean, of course, it's empty insofar as there are no bits of matter. When there are bits of matter, then it's filled just with those bits. And but space is passive. Time, as Newton said, flows inequitably through all eternity. That means it doesn't enter into the play. And all that happens is this playing around with each other. That's a completely different picture from what we have today. Because what we have today is emerging, the view that's emerging is that everything is embedded into an energy field that I consider is also an information field. And so everything that we know is actually part of this very basic fundamental field that fills all of space, all of a total change over 180 degrees change from our conventional view of reality.
And what took real part in this? You know, we're not here as, you know, sort of observers in the world that's happening around us. So there is a cause and effect value of what we do as individuals. One of the things that you say is you talk about, you know, the consciousness research, and we talk about the idea of transpersonal connections between the consciousness of one person and the mind and body of another. So I'm sitting here and I'm talking to you, and there are thoughts going on in my head. And so the sense that I get from this is that, you know, the thinking that happens in my area of it really affects your area of consciousness. Is that correct? Am I correct in jumping to that conclusion?
Well, the conclusion that you jumped to has been jumped upon, or jumped to, has been jumped to for 5,000 years.
Yeah.
Because traditional cultures, particularly in the East, have been very certain that the consciousness of one person can affect the consciousness of others.
We're just catching up here, though.
We're rediscovering many things that we're knowing intuitively. And that's actually a proof of the pudding in a way, you know. Because if an idea has been present intuitively for many, many generations, it can't be completely wrong. Because it shows up when people's intuitions can be very strong. Its intuitions are something that we allow to come into our minds when we don't suppress it, don't restrict it artificially. And so when something comes like this comes up, that we can affect each other through the way we think, through our consciousness, that if that keeps coming up over generations, in fact hundreds, if thousands of years, then I think there is something to it. I think traditional people have known this and are using it.
You know. Yes.
And I think in the animal kingdom, most of the mammalian species are actually connecting with each other in ways that we don't. We are only now discovering that it's possible to do.
And we're learning this through observing them. I think we talked about Jane Goodall yesterday.
Yes.
You know, a bit in the work that she's done.
Yes, it finds that animals can respond to us, and as well, of course, they respond to each other. They know what's happening. You know. Recently I had a little experience. I live in Italy, out in the country.
Uh-huh.
And I have a dog, and we had several cats, and one of the cats keep producing offspring, you know. And so we always keep some, but we're getting too many. And one that has been sort of 6 months old, we gave away to friends who have been about 30 miles, lives about 30 miles away in a farmhouse. So we took this little young cat over there, and we left it there, and we said, fine, they'll be taken care of it, and now at least we have one cat less at this point. 2 days later, the cat showed up.
Yeah.
Over 30 miles, you know, how find a way, because it took her over by car.
Right.
You know, can find a way. I suppose it would, even for longer distances, they would find it. And that's not ordinary orientation. There's no way you could memorize the road.
Mm-hmm.
You know? They just find a way. We call it instinct, but I'm sure what we call instinct and what we call intuition, or even prophetic insight, if you like. Of course, I go very quickly from the prophets to
yes, exactly.
from the cats to the prophets.
Why not?
I mean, yes. This is all basically tapping into what I call this information field,
mm-hmm.
you know, the Akashic field.
Well, you know, we spend a lot of time explaining, you know, away the connection that you just mentioned. I mean, you know, there is this notion that, yes, let's really jump to that place where perhaps there is a communication going on between the cat, as you talked about it, and yourself. And yet sometimes when we walk through this earth, you know, we get these what we call intuitive hits. and we spend a lot of time convincing ourselves that we really don't hear these things. Isn't that, you know, based on the belief systems we have?
Well, this is why it's so important to find quote-unquote scientific proof.
Yes.
Because science, after all, has taken the place of religion, at least in regard to certifying beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
If science claims that a state of affairs is confirmed because it's been experimentally verified and nice mathematics back it up, then most people are ready to believe that that's the way it is.
Yes, show me the numbers.
That's right. I mean, this is really the function of science to legitimize our beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very important right now that these intuitions, which we ordinarily bracket out because we say that they are just stupidities or illusions or mythic imagination, which of course now we know that myth has a very important function also,
mm-hmm.
but in everyday context, I mean, the Western world, people say, I mean, this is just, you're just dreaming. And this word, by the way, is very interesting because when you say just dreaming, it could be very significant. When people are dreaming, many important things can happen in coming into their heads.
I know, we stick that word just in to really undermine the experience.
Yeah, well, dreaming, and especially white dreaming, you know, the kind of free-floating associations that one has just after one wakes up or just before one goes to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
I've known many scientists. One of them was Jonas Salk, you know, the inventor of the polio vaccine, who told me that most of his ideas come to him in wide dreaming states. Early in the morning, around 5 o'clock, he has a little tape recorder there. When he wakes up, he just puts on his tape recorder and he starts just verbalizing what has come to his head.
Mm-hmm.
And then the secretary has transcribed it and has showed it to me. It's full of insights. Very highly repetitive, of course. He keeps saying, I see this and
yes,
and now things are moving together and so on. But the elements of most of his ideas, those that led to the discovery of the polio vaccine, for example, were all there in this wide dream state. So, of course, many things that when we don't filter out the information that's coming to us,
then
many more things are coming to us than we believe can possibly do. You know?
I love the term filter out. I mean, you know, that we have many, many ways that we talk about filtering out and many things that we do so we actually don't hear the voice. I mean, you know, you can plug yourself into television or you can plug yourself into the distractions of the earth and the world and, you know, all that goes on. And the next thing you know, it's hard to get, you know, intuitively in touch with the voice that's really maybe trying to transmit something, you know, from other people, places, and things.
Yes, I think this information field, as we've been talking about it, and I'll be glad to repeat the main elements of it, is one that has a tremendous capacity for storing information.
Mm-hmm.
And the best guess that we have is that it's a holographic storage, because in a holograph, it's fantastic how much information you can store in what's a small space, far more than in a computer disk. Now, this, we're all amazed about how much a computer can store. Now, I'm traveling with a little memory chip, you know, which has practically all my files in it.
I know.
And it's just 2 inches long. This is a giant compared to the holographic recording. It's been calculated some time ago that if you take a holographic medium, which allows superposition of these holographic interference patterns, about the size of a cube of sugar, you can record all of the contents of the Library of Congress.
Mm. Yes, and that, you know, let's talk more about that. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, more with Dr. Irvin Laszlo, the pioneer of systems thinking, and, you know, and we are honored to be here with him today and talk about a new paradigm, touching on, you know, the holistic paradigm, and we'll talk more about his new book in the Akasha Factor, and also talk about how each and every one of us as individuals, the beliefs that we hold, that will either get in the way of us tuning in to this vacuum or allowing the information to flow so that we actually hear that voice. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Crustbusting Your Way to an Awesome Life with Dr. Pat. If you would like to participate in today's program, call in at 1-888-335-5204. Now let's join Dr. Pat for some serious crust busting.
Welcome back. Yep, you're listening to me, Dr. Pat Basile, and I am honored to have with me today on the show Dr. Irvin Laszlo. We are really heating up the airwaves here with our conversation and the insights from Dr. Laszlo. And I mentioned before, you know, all that he has done, the numerous awards, the distinctions, including a current nomination for a Nobel Peace Prize. And we'll talk a little bit about that. I'm going to get his feeling about that. But right now we're talking about his latest book, Science and the Akashic Field, an Integral Theory of Everything. I love that. When will the book be out?
Sometime this fall. We'll try to make it so it doesn't coincide exactly with the elections, either before or after.
Yeah. Would it be like before or would it be after? It would be great to go before.
Well, perhaps, but there has to be at least a month before. Yes.
Let's talk a little bit. You touched on the idea of beliefs and, you know, the beliefs that we hold. And I asked you a question about how does the new holistic paradigm, you know, affect the way that we go out into the world, you know, in creating the new myth? And what are some of the beliefs that we hold that need to change?
Well, I think the principal one is really what the separateness. You know, if you believe that you are really separate, you are here and now, and the other person is over there, and it's just completely separate from you, then you don't feel any responsibility. Then you act the way you want to act, you know. So then it becomes a struggle for survival, and the strongest rightfully survives. And so that's one of the beliefs that has got to go, because we are not all that separate. There's a beautiful saying by William James, the great psychologist. He said that we are all like islands in the sea. Mm-hmm. You know, at first sight, I mean, you think, well, then we are separate. But then he goes on to say, we may be separate on the surface, but we are connected in the deep.
Mm-hmm.
And he also says, even the trees in the forest, they are separate trees, but they commingle their roots.
Yes, they do.
In underneath. So this is the way it is. Underneath it all, underneath the manifest world, we are really connected with each other and have always been. But we have, in the past couple of hundred years in the Western world, have ignored these connections, thinking that we have got all the solutions to everything by simply using the mechanical connections that we can create through technology. So separateness is one of the things. But following from that is, for example, an outdated belief that I owe allegiance only to one country and to one people. You know, you can have one flag and that's the only flag there is. In Europe, it's now very interesting, this process of the European Union integration, you know, because French people and Germans have historically didn't get along, you know, and the English didn't think they should be part of all that. But now, increasingly, you find that you have your national identity, and you also have a kind of a continental identity, mm-hmm. you're beginning to. A country that, as my native country, Hungary, has just joined the Union, you know, the 1st of mm-hmm. May, together with 9 other countries from Eastern and Central Europe. And there, too, I mean, people are really happy to embrace a larger identity. So what I'm saying is that an appropriate belief, a belief that's functional, so to speak, yes. and it's up to date, would be that we have, yes, we have our national identity, just like we have our personal identity and have a cultural identity, but we also have a human identity. We are also a member of the human race. And so perhaps you could embrace that the UN flag as well, mm-hmm. you know, not as an organization, but as a community of people. You know, I think the UN itself, by the way, needs to be reformed, and sooner or later it's bound to be reformed also, from becoming just a membership of nations and mm-hmm. governments to be made of a community of peoples and cultures, you know. But this means that we have to have allegiance, multiple allegiances. Individuals as citizens of a country, and as members of a culture, a member of the whole human family.
Isn't the idea of understanding each of us as humans first the first call to order?
Well, we have to understand each other. It even goes beyond that,
yeah.
you know, as humans first, but not quite first.
Okay.
First as living beings.
Okay.
Uh-huh. You know. Because we are also part of the biosphere.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be born onto this planet that has been around for over 5 billion years. surprisingly enough, you know, about 4.2 billion years ago, already the first signs of life were there. And 3.5 billion years ago, already pretty complex, you know, single-celled organisms, but they're already very complex.
Mm-hmm.
And how they would have come about purely by random mixing is still a mystery.
Yes.
You know, there's no solution to that. I personally believe, and I'm saying so in my new book, that it's very likely that this whole process of the origins of life was seeded from elsewhere in the universe, but not by actually bringing in the DNA, mm-hmm. as some other theories hold, but I think informationally, because life has probably in the universe has developed by that time elsewhere, and life in one place actually isn't informationally contacted, communicating with life in other places.
Mm-hmm.
So chances are that life has could evolve fast because it has had received a so-called a little prompt from elsewhere in the universe. You know?
Oh, well, that will give people a lot to think about. Really?
That is a marvelous example given by a physicist who died last year, a famous physicist, Sir Fred Hoyle. And Hoyle said, take as an example for what difference information makes, you know, in a process. Take an example of the Rubik's Cube. You know what the Rubik's Cube is?
Yes.
You know,
mm-hmm.
the cube that has six faces.
Oh, boy, I ever.
You know, and you can twist it.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a random point, and you start twisting it randomly. Now, if you give this, a Rubik's Cube, to a blind person, says Hoyle, and so he doesn't know whether any twist he gives it will bring him closer to ordering it
mm-hmm.
or not. He'll have to go to be sure that he gets it ordered. He'll have to show all the possibilities. And all the possibilities, Hoyle being a mathematician, calculated all the possibilities, and it's, I think it's 10 on the 26th power of mm-hmm. number of possibilities. And if you allow 1 second for each move to take, then to go through all the possibilities, you will need about twice the age of the universe.
Wow.
Now, but look at the difference if you get a prompt. Suppose a person twists it and he knows, he gets an idea whether he gets closer or further, whether it was the right or the wrong twist.
Mm-hmm.
You know? If he gets a prompt, he can do it on the average 120 moves.
Yeah, isn't that prompt, you know, what we refer to as intuition a lot of times?
That's precisely
it.
I mean, a prompt. It makes an enormous difference. I think evolution on any level is conceivable purely by the random process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but if you had connection, a kind of a prompt, whether it's conscious or whether it affects your DNA, or it affects your cells in your body, or whether it affects, you know, the particles perhaps that are moving about in cosmic space, but it's the universe builds on the information that it has already generated.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only way it can progress. Otherwise, it's be, you know, like the blind watchmaker. Every time it makes a wrong move, it all falls apart and can start all over again.
That's right.
You'll never get anywhere.
Right. Well, and so, again, the beliefs that we hold are instrumental in allowing us to really, you know, see the power of the new paradigm.
Yeah, a paradigm of connectivity.
Yes.
Meaning that we are connected in more ways than we know, than we could think of, but not more ways than we can intuit, because intuitively we have that.
Mm-hmm.
In our dreams we have that. And in so-called altered states, that's where the new psychology, like transpersonal psychology, is discovering.
Yes.
Then you move into a deeper state, a deeper level, then these connections come through. Let me tell you about experiments that I have witnessed myself, you know, which have to do with information being carried over, conveyed from one person to another. Now, this information very often requires to be conveyed over that the individuals who are doing it entering a deeper state, meditative state. So we had this experiment, which was carried out a number of times, first in Germany, then in Italy, with people that I know. One of them was a very gifted healer called Dr. Maria Sagi, also from Hungary, who was a colleague of mine in the Club of Budapest. And she discovered this fantastic potential she has for healing spontaneously. And we did experiments, controlled experiments, even in large seminars where 100 people present, you know, when they have monitors were put on large screens and people could watch the EEG patterns, the electroencephalograph patterns of hers and of a person that volunteers from the public, you see. And she was in another room, absolutely no contact, sensory contact whatsoever, and this person was over here. And she started going into a meditative state, and we found the on the display that the EEG patterns are going getting lower and lower on the famous, from the normal beta level, which is the normal waking state. We're going down to the alpha level, which is the sort of the happiness trance state. And then they dipped into the deeper state of the delta, which is between 0 and 3 hertz, you know, frequency per second. And normally people are in deep sleep. And she wasn't in a deep sleep. And that's the kind of state that she was working on when she was sending this kind of healing information to the other person. First they interacted, so first they got to know each other. They're 10 minutes together, you see. Because very important factor, yes, that people get to know each other. And then we saw on the monitor of the EEG pattern of the patient or the young subject of the experiment also started going down. Now he just sat there with closed eyes, wasn't asleep, and it went into the delta pattern. And then she started sending from the other room a particular pattern. And about 3 seconds later, the pattern showed up in the young man's EEG also. And there's no contact with her, no sensory contact. In fact, it was also in a Faraday cage, so there's no electromagnetic radiation could also get through. So I think this has been a further confirmation that the connections exist if we allow them to work, to penetrate. And this kind of healing, whether it's healing information or just spontaneous communication. I think I don't want to just go on too long on this, but I just want to tell you that I am convinced that high state of creativity, you know, have to do with this. And Mozart, for example, not composing by himself. I even said so, that, or comes to him in his sleep, he said, you know. I think high state of creativity, Einstein said that also. It's a mystery. I mean, somehow it's intuition, he said. It's more important than reason. And I think I've collected a number of statements by famous physicists and scientists also, because you expect artists to say so, but you don't expect scientists.
Exactly.
And they all admit that this is what's happening. My own experience has been such that if I come across with an idea and I try to work it out in my mind and I sit down and sort of write it out, then the sentences begin to flow. So the ideas start writing themselves.
Yes.
And I often don't even know exactly what I was writing until I read it back. You know? So I think I'm not doing it alone. One can get switched in.
I agree with you. And, you know, each and every day we hear more and more stories of people that are, you know, taking action and doing things and can't really explain. I mean, people ask me all the time, where do I get this idea from? And, you know, I call it divine intuition. You know, it's like here you are and we're having this conversation. And in the moment, you know, there are things that come to each of us, ideas of how we're to make this connection right here now. Let's take a short break. When we come back, we're going to open up the microphone here for questions, bring the audience into the conversation, a conversation with Dr. Irvin Laszlo, pioneer in systems thinking. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Crossbusting Your Way to an Awesome Life with Dr. Pat. If you would like to participate in today's program, call in at 1-888-335-5204. Now let's join Dr. Pat for some serious crossbusting.
Welcome back, and welcome to, you know, this amazing conversation that we're having. I'm here with Dr. Irvin Laszlo, founder and president of the Club of Budapest and so many other things, published nearly 70 books, translated into many, many languages. And we're talking about science in the Akashic field. We're talking about the connectivity of consciousness, of thought, of mind, of body, and the new paradigm, the holistic paradigm. And we have a question, so tell us your name and join in.
Thank you. My name is Ellie Spitz, and I would just like to continue your last point, which is you spoke about the gifted creativity of Mozart and Einstein. In the transpersonal field, some speak of Mozart's ability to compose at a young age, due to memories from previous lives. Like your response on the relationship, first, if you believe there is memory from previous life, and secondly, if creativity is gained beyond the brain, and if so, how?
Well, I think both of these questions, my answer would be yes. Even though I don't hold to the classical traditional idea of reincarnation. Let me try to elaborate on that. I think it follows from the theory that I developed, the theory of what I call the Akashic field, or simply the A field, which I think is just will be just as fundamental a field as the G field, the gravitational field, or the EM field, the electromagnetic field, or quantum fields. It follows from this theory of the A field that everything that happens, including the workings of the brain of all individuals, is entering the field, is being recorded there, just the same way as if you would be typing it into the internet through the computer. You know, it all is conserved. Information is simply generated and is conserved, whereas we know that energy is a little different. Energy is conserved, but it can't be created and can't be destroyed. I would say information, likewise, cannot be destroyed, but it can be and it is being created. Mm-hmm. So information is accumulating in the universe at all, constantly. Now, it would follow then that an individual, throughout his life, produces a large number of bits of information, so to speak, and all of which is integrated into this new sphere or collective unconscious or whatever name we want to give it, which is an information field surrounding us here on this planet. And it is possible for other individuals to tap into this field, to read out from it. Sometimes because you're accidentally sort of hardwired similarly to the brain of another person, so you pick up, like we know children very often can pick out information from a deceased person, from another person, from a person on the other side of the globe. It doesn't matter from where or how long ago it was. And all of a sudden they seem to recognize it, or the scenes, or even speak languages that the other one did. Now, in the case of a great creativity, a surprising creativity, it becomes very evident that such a person, in this case, we're talking about Mozart, may have had this incredible fluke, actually, a serendipity, of being able to pick out information from this field that is ordinarily not present to ordinary mortals, to other people. So it is not necessarily from a past life, and certainly I wouldn't say that it's necessarily from a previous life. I don't believe that lives are being lived over again. I'm willing to suspend judgment on that. I mean, that is somehow a very, very deep question. But what I can affirm with some good level of confidence is that the experiences that we have in our lifetime are there, and they can be read out again if you allow these experiences to penetrate, if you don't filter them out. Often they come to us in dreams. To Mozart, they also came sort of in dreams, but he remembered them when he woke up, and he couldn't write them down. You know? So I think creativity altogether is a collective endeavor. It's not an individual's mind.
Well, you know, isn't it possible then, and to really talk about, you can change the world. This is a book you wrote, The Global Citizen's Handbook on Living, for Living on Planet Earth. The idea and the belief then would have to be that we are all at choice in how we create the future. We decide that which is to come. And isn't the shift in belief one that takes us from we don't have choice, that world is happening around us and we're just here kind of going for the ride, to one where we get to choose peace in the world?
Well, here he has to take another factor into account, because it's very true what you say. We do have a really, really choice. We can make an impact, a decisive impact. But here you have to take two other factors into account. One is that we live in a complex system that is at the edge of its stability, at the very edge of its sustainability. We talk about the sustainability or non-sustainability of the world. This system is now so stressed in terms of its resources, in terms of its populations, in terms of the contrast that are between rich and poor, between different belief systems, between different ambitions, it's so stressed that it's very difficult for the system to be kept in the present state, to be prolonged the present state. In which almost everything is possible today except the status quo. You just can't stay like the way
yes.
you are. It's like riding a bicycle.
It's no longer an option.
Know? I mean, you can't stand still if you ride a bicycle unless you're an acrobat. Even then, it's very tiring.
Mm-hmm.
But you also can't go backwards, but you can go forward, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you have to choose the direction. So that's one of the factors. The other factor is this connection. Now, imagine we have an unstable system where all its elements are connected to all its other elements, more strongly connected than we used to believe. That means that if you change even a little bit on one of the system, one of the parts of the system, the others will feel the effects.
Mm-hmm.
This is standard theory now, is so-called chaos theory.
Yes.
You know, the chaos dynamics, we know that these chaotic systems have what is known as chaotic attractors or strange attractors. And they have what is known also as the butterfly effect.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Of course, the popular version of the butterfly effect is that you have a monarch butterfly in California flapping its wings unexpectedly, and then it creates a storm over Outer Mongolia
yes.
the following week because it propagates, you know, mm-hmm. and amplifies. But the actual, of course, the background for the butterfly effect is the shape of the attractor. These attractors are computing devices, and the first time this kind of attractor emerged was when Edward Lorenz in the 1960s, a U.S. meteorologist, tried to map the world weather system, and he was wondering how come that you can't make reliable forecasts for more than a couple of days, and he found that he has this kind of an attractor. When he maps the states of the system, you get a kind of a thing where once the system can evolve in one direction, can evolve in another direction, and a tiny input can flip it over from one to the other.
Mm.
You know, so we constantly have what is now this known as a tipping point.
Yeah. What is it going to take then, given this complex nature of the system that, you know, that we call life right now? What is it going to take to establish peace in the world?
As strange as it may seem, the answer seems to be esoteric, but it isn't. It's very concrete. It takes a new consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
It takes simply a recognition, a deeper recognition, that we have a role, that we are part of each other, and therefore we have a responsibility not only for ourselves and our family and our company and our city and our nation, but for all of humanity. And in some ways, being aware of this already will start suggesting courses of action whereby we don't waste, we don't stress things. Very simple matters. 10 days ago, I was invited to give a talk at a conference, which surprised me why they would get me over there, because I'm not a particular expert in that field.
Mm.
It was a water conference in Jordan, at the shores of the Dead Sea. The title of the conference was the first international conference on water demand management, a very complex title. But when you break it down, it turns out that what we are talking about, how can we use water more efficiently?
There you go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that again, it turns out that for very little input, you can cut down on the flow of water, the way you flush the toilet, for example, you're putting something on the faucet, you know, which aerates the flow, mm-hmm. which you don't need to use it so strongly, you can still get you can wash your hands very well. And little, tiny little things can happen. Just being aware of the fact that you should conserve water as a precious resource mm-hmm. is not enough for all people on this earth already as it is. So, that you have a role. You have a role when it comes to water, when it comes to gas or fuel of the fossil fuels use, when it comes to burning trash in the open air, you know, which puts CO2 into the atmosphere, all kinds of ways that you are behaving, that the way you eat, for example, your preferences for foods. It takes an awful lot of water and energy to produce 1 kilogram or 1 pound of beef, for example, and about 200-300 times less to produce the equivalent amount of soya, which is very similar caloric values.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so all this sort of thing, it's all around us. And if you ask, what does it take? It takes waking up, becoming conscious, becoming aware that we're living on a small planet. We are already crowding it. We are already stressing it. But there are ways that we can behave, that we can act, which is responsible vis-a-vis other people, and fortunately also healthier, more natural, you know, simpler.
Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll conclude our discussion with Dr. Irvin Laszlo, take other questions from the audience. Thank you for your question, and talk more about the role that each and every one of us must play to contribute to the, you know, the living on the planet Earth in a way that we can all survive here. Thank you, Dr. Laszlo. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Crustbusting Your Way to an Awesome Life with Dr. Pat. If you would like to participate in today's program, call in at 1-888-335-5204. Now let's join Dr. Pat for some serious crustbusting.
Welcome back, and welcome back to this amazing show and conversation with Dr. Irvin Laszlo. And I mentioned earlier the amazing things that he has done, and what he's doing right now for me and for our listening audience is inviting us to a different discussion, a discussion about a new paradigm. And it's an invitation for each and every one of us to open our minds, open our hearts, and know that we are all connected in a way that we probably can't, you know, quantify in the current moment, and it is about consciousness. So thank you for joining me today on the show, Dr. Laszlo. Now, we have a question from the audience. Welcome to the show. Yes. Now, tell us who you are.
I'm J.C. Trump, and it's an honor to be here listening to your theories, Dr. Laszlo. And my question would be, if we're sitting here in America, for instance, I know geographically I don't want to limit it too much, but for instance, we're sitting here in America and we look at people over in Iraq right now during the war. How can people get to the point where they can realize that we share so many different things with someone all the way across the world and possibly put that toward world peace?
Well, I think that's happening already. It's ordinary empathy. You can empathize with people. We get more and more information now from others. Look, I think it's the upsurge of spontaneous empathy with the people who were tortured in the prison, for example. You know, all of a sudden, they were not just so nameless enemies. They were human beings who were subjected to evidently unjust treatment. And if you think of other people, put yourself in their position and empathize with them. It's very funny, you know, if you're so artificially broken up. I mean, we talk about some people who give their lives what they consider to be a patriotic act or an act of their deepest spiritual convictions. Of course, we can say that they have been brainwashed, that they have false beliefs, etc. But they sacrifice themselves for what they believe to be a just cause. That's the crux of the matter. We consider them criminals or terrorists. I mean, by we, as the average person in the Western world. On the other side, in the Arab world, I come recently from Jordania, and you get the perspective from the other side. I mean, most normal, intelligent Arabs would not say that terrorism is a right course of action. But they also would agree that they have been misled, these young people, with these kamikazes. But they are quite certain that they are fighting for a cause that through other means anybody would fight for. When you have your own territory, your own country, and when you feel that this country has been invaded by an outside force. Of course, if the invasion came originally to liberate you from a dictator, I think it was welcome at that time. But when it becomes an ongoing occupation, a presence there, then it becomes increasingly irritant and irritating, just like in your body. If something enters into artificially and it stays there, even if you have a surgical intervention, imagine if the knife, which at first does something good, you know, cuts out a tumor, if you would leave the knife in there, you know, it would be terrible. I think one can understand on a human level, but then if you can go on a deeper level as well, allow your feelings to enter into play and to try to meditate, to pray, all of these things actually help to focus the mind, and all of a sudden you will feel spontaneously a greater relationship to people, to other people, despite of the fact that they are another part of the world, that they have another belief system, there are other ways of living. They're still human beings. You can feel related to another animal. I feel very strongly related to Nikki, who's my dog, you mm-hmm. know. And it's certainly to us a human being, no matter where that person lives and what he thinks. We are cousins, our brothers and sisters, actually. So if we allow our mind to open up, I think we will develop a much greater solidarity in the world. And if you ask what this world really needs is, I would agree with the Dalai Lama, who says that we need more solidarity. You know.
Thank you. Let's talk a minute about solidarity, because I want to get back to the belief systems that we talked about earlier from the book that you wrote, You Can Change the World, The Global Citizen's Handbook for Living on Planet Earth. How do we create this solidarity? What are the beliefs that we need to let go of? Beliefs that no longer serve a holistic paradigm, a holistic view of the world. What are some of the beliefs that we can invite our listeners to contemplate, and contemplate in a way that they would be able to take action on letting go of them, to at least allow the opportunity for solidarity to come in?
Well, we have to open our minds and embrace a wider range of issues, a wider range of considerations. Typically, and I think probably this is a stereotype, it's no real person is exactly like that, but I mean typically one could say the modern Western person believes that money rules the world, nothing else really counts, everything, the value of everything can be calculated in money. They go to extremes such as saying, well, before you get married, you should count out what you are saving, what you're going to spend, etc., reducing everything practically to quantitative monetary terms. And only what counts is your own immediate benefit, your own immediate interest. And these interests are key to becoming richer, or having more control over things, more powerful, more famous. And these factors are the only things that count, and everything else is just idle conversation. It's fine to talk about it, you know, by sitting in front of a fireplace when you have nothing else to do. But when you go into the office or into the workplace, you know, what really counts is money and power.
Mm-hmm.
And these beliefs have got us to where we are, very polarized in the world, to such an extent where about, let's say, 500 super rich individuals own collectively about as much money as 3 billion, half of the world's population.
Right.
And tremendous disparities where, you know, 20% of the world population consumes 84% of the goods.
Mm-hmm.
Tremendous disparities. When we recognize that this kind of thinking will only polarize the world in which we live, and ultimately is not good for us, even for the powerful, because the powerful is now getting, and the rich is getting increasingly threatened. Look at all over the world now, people are putting up fences, they're putting up walls around their houses.
Yes.
You should see how it is in all over Latin America, all over the Far East. When you have a wealthy person, it puts so high walls that you can't even see around it, and they have little watchtowers, you know, by the entrance, if you can afford that, because people feel threatened. So it's not good, even for the rich and for the powerful, and not to mention those who are starving and you know, trying to just survive. So we have to learn to live in a world that's very highly connected, that doesn't live on money alone and on economic goods alone. Also, you need, obviously, those goods so that you can survive. But once you have enough, once you can keep body and soul together, people are looking for other things, to have other needs also. Social values, they need cultural values, they need to find some meaning in their existence, they need to have a sense that they're producing something, that they are contributing to society in some way, and that their group has somehow a legitimacy, you know, that they're not outcasts mm-hmm. in the world and not second-class citizens. All this we need to do because we have created, through our technology, incredible interdependence in the world, and at the same time, we have created, as we have created a global world, we have maintained a tribal mentality.
Mm.
In It's doing negative things about tribes, because the tribal mentality was far more advanced than some of today's mentality is, actually.
And some of the rituals and traditions.
Yes, because the tribes knew very well that they are connected to each other.
Yes, they
Whereas
did.
Today we often feel that, you know, it's my company and that's all I care about, and the competition has to be shut down as fast as possible, because that's the way to get ahead. Mm-hmm. And then it turns out often, even in the business context, that when you have disbalance a whole market sector, then you can't handle it anymore, and sooner or later, you know, that monopoly will fall also, because you just can't keep it up, can't mm-hmm. keep it stable. You need an interplay of several actors that are competing, yes, but they also have something in common. They have a common interest to maintain their branch of activity and to create something that is of value to people. Mm-hmm. So another belief here, very briefly, is when you talk about the business sphere, is to move from the belief that in your business the only interest you have is to serve the shareholders. The shareholders are the owners. And some 20 years ago or so, Milton Friedman said in a very influential article in the New York Times that the only responsibility of management is to make profit for the shareholders. Mm-hmm. And that was 20 years ago, and a lot of
we still hold on to
hold
that
on
one,
to that.
Boy. That one is still alive and well.
But it's becoming very negative effects, because the shareholder, in addition to the shareholders, now you have another concept, which is the stakeholders.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in some companies, forward-looking companies, employees also can have shares in the company, but in most companies they don't. So you have your employees, which are not shareholders in most places. And then you have your partners. And then you have the local communities. You have the whole ecosystems. And all of them are part of your business operation. And so this is sometimes called the stakeholder philosophy, which means that taking responsibility for everybody who is around you, who is affected by your operations. The same way as an individual has to take care that his or her lifestyles and behaviors and modes of communication, you know, are spreading a responsible attitude, mm-hmm. a responsible behavior. The same way a business has to take care that, of course, its behavior is not concentrating benefits on this very small group and having negative benefits, these benefits, to a large group.
To the majority of people.
Mm-hmm. The government is the same way. I mean, a governmental action has to be such that it's good for all nations, basically, and not only for one at the expense of the other. You know, in terms of a very popular expression, originally was a mathematical theory, game theory. But nowadays you talk about win-lose and win-win.
Win-lose, win-win,
yeah,
right.
Exactly. Came from game theory originally. But now we know that in many cases, in the majority of cases, when it comes to strategic decisions, you can choose decisions that have win-win outcomes, that benefit you, or benefit the individual doing it, but benefit also the partners and the other people who are affected by that, instead of playing the kind of game where if I win, then you must give up, you know, the equivalent amount, so you lose. So you asked about changes of mentality. There are many, many instances, mm-hmm. and all of these really basically center on the fact we have created a globalized world. We have to learn to live in that globalized world.
And remember that we really are connected.
We're really one, basically.
We are really one.
We are really one.
And that's the message that we'll leave you with today, to contemplate and to take some action about. We are really one. Thank you so much for joining me today and for being able to have this wonderful conversation with you. And we look forward to the book when it comes out. Please let us know when it does, so that we can bring you back and have this conversation and allow people to get a hold of this book and really uplift and enlighten themselves in a way that they can connect to a purpose greater than themselves.
Well, thank you, Pat, for inviting me. My purpose is really to try to communicate, because these insights that I try to put down in writing are not much good if they stay in the heads of a few people. They have to spread in society. So I try this time to really write a book. I've written many books for science, for the science community, but I've tried this time to write this book on the science and the Akashic field, which is meant for the large public. And I hope to get a feedback. I hope to engage in a dialogue. I'll be very happy to respond to anybody who wants to comment on this.
Thank you so much for being out there for really communicating and sharing your thoughts and enabling us to join with you in the creative process of the world. Thank you so much.
Thank you again.
Thank you, listening audience. Until next time, make yourself a fabulous, fabulous, fabulous day. We'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us today for Crust Busting with Dr. Pat Pacilli. Crust Busting with Dr. Pat can be heard live every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time on voiceamerica.com. For a copy of today's program or to learn more about Crust Busting, visit www.crustbusting.com.